We would like to welcome to the club our most recent Patreon supporters, Juliet and Shanice. Thank you so much for your support.
Explicit content is found in this episode. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome back to the True Crime Fan Club Podcast. I'm your host, Lainey. When you think of Waco, Texas, you might think of the controversial college, Baylor, or maybe you think of the home improvement show starring Chip and Joanna Gaines. If you're a true crime listener and reader, you've likely heard of one of the most brutal murders to occur in the small city. Okay, on to the show. Today, Waco, Texas is infamously known as the city where the ATF confronted a religious cult called the Branch Davidians that led to a 51-day standoff. The standoff ended after a fire broke out in the Branch Davidian compound, and 76 men, women, and children were killed in the inferno. The way the ATF handled the situation has sparked many discussions on government overreach and law enforcement tactics. But it's not the only case from Waco that has led to philosophical musings. The Lake Waco murders of 1982 initially seemed like a straightforward case, but after the exoneration of one of the men sent to death row for the murders, we're left with questions about the initial investigation, the convictions, and about the death penalty. The summer of 1982 was a violent one for the city of Waco. About a dozen people had already been killed that year in the city of 100,000, including two cops who had been gunned down the month before. However, if the only thing you knew about Waco was that it had a lake, then you would think it was an idyllic paradise. Lake Waco lies just inside the western border of the city. The Jewel Blue Lake was created in 1930 when the Bosque River was dammed. Now, the lake is bordered by six parks with white sand beaches. The largest of the parks was Spiegelville, and it was a wonderful place to hike, fish, and camp. It was also the place where the bodies of 18-year-old Kenneth Parks, 17-year-old Raylene Rice, and 18-year-old Jill Montgomery were found. Jill and Kenneth met at Waco's Methodist Children's Home. Both suffered from dyslexia and caused trouble at school and home. The home was supposed to help them get back on track. For a while, the pair dated, but were later just friends. Right before her death, Jill had returned to her family home. However, she wanted to travel back to Waco in order to get some records from the Methodist home, as well as pick up her final paycheck from being a tour guide at Fort Fisher. Her friend Raylene offered to drive Jill to Waco in her orange Ford Pinto. On the day of the murder, the girls picked up Kenneth from his father's house. It was Kenneth's father who would file a missing persons report with the police once his son did not return home the next day. Today we know that the men and women investigating crimes are just as important to take into consideration as the evidence they collect. In a perfect world, investigators would put aside their biases and look at every crime scene with an impartial eye. But we live in a far-from-perfect world, so when a case becomes controversial like this one, every person involved is put under a microscope. Patrol Sergeant Truman Simons would ultimately be the police officer most associated with the initial investigation of this crime. Officer Simons was someone who, even while his peers were moving into desk jobs, loved to work on the streets. Solving crime gave him purpose, and he was dedicated to that purpose. He was also someone who preferred to work alone, so he was able to follow his gut instincts and not have to explain himself to anyone. Around 6:30 p.m. on July 14th, Officer Simons responded to a call of a body that was found at Spiegelville Park near Lake Waco. Two men who were looking for a place to fish came upon what they thought was a mannequin propped up against a tree, but upon closer inspection, it became clear it was a dead man. The body was that of Kenneth Franks, who had been reported missing earlier that day. Kenneth's orange shirt was covered in blood from the multiple stab wounds he had in his chest. He was gagged, with his hands bound behind his back. Whoever left him there had put his half-tinted aviators back on his face. Officers looked at the photo of Kenneth that came with his report and felt confident that they had found him. Officers had a sinking feeling. Kenneth's missing persons report indicated that there should have been two young women from Waxahachie with him. Officer Simons took charge and ordered the other officers and deputies at the scene to spread out and begin searching. It didn't take long for the officers to find the body of Raylene Rice about 75 feet away. She was naked except for her bra, which was tied around her right leg. Her hands were tied behind her back and she was gagged. She also had been stabbed repeatedly. Close by, officers noticed a bent knee rising above the weeds. The knee belonged to Jill Montgomery. Like Raylene, she was naked, bound, gagged, and had been stabbed multiple times. Unlike Raylene, her throat had been slashed. The autopsies of the victims painted a clear picture of what happened to them. Kenneth suffered 20 stab and cutting wounds in his left neck and chest. The instrument used on him was a single-edge blade between 1/2 and 3/4 inch wide and 4 to 5 inches in length. The overall direction of the wounds were from above downward, from front to back, and slightly from left to right. His blood alcohol level was 0.049%, and his drug screen was negative. It was concluded that Kenneth died from multiple stab wounds, with wounds 1 through 11 causing the most significant internal injuries and hemorrhage. Raylene had 11 stab wounds on her neck and chest. The blade that was used on her was the same as the blade used on Kenneth and Jill. She also had abrasions on her right thigh and her right labia majora and minora. There were also contusions found on the interior wall of her vagina. Like Jill, Raylene's rape kit was negative for ejaculation, but it's clear that both women were sexually assaulted by the injuries sustained to their vaginas. Raylene's blood alcohol level was 0.045%, and her drug screen was negative. It was concluded that she died from multiple stab wounds on her neck and chest. Jill had 3 cutting wounds on her neck and 14 stab wounds in the left chest. Jill also had 5 cutting wounds on her right hand and fingers, which seemed to me to be defensive wounds. The blade that caused her wounds was the same as the one used on Kenneth. There was a red contusion on her vagina, but her rape kit was negative for ejaculation. Her blood alcohol level was 0.013%, and her drug screen was negative. It was concluded that Jill died as a result of the multiple cutting and stab wounds in her left chest and neck. From the start, there were questions about the crime scene. Detectives learned from Kenneth's father that the girls had picked him up the day before, but after that, there were no sightings of the trio. Police had no idea why the bodies were found on the other side of the lake where Raylene's car was parked. Police found empty beer cans next to her car, but could not lift any fingerprints. The grass around the girls' bodies was flattened as if there was a struggle, but there was no murder weapon and very little blood. There was also no evidence of a boat or tire tracks that could show police how the bodies got there. Police were baffled by the lack of evidence. Officer Dennis Beyer would later say, "As a police department, we were totally unprepared for the complexity of this case." The murder shocked Waco PD, who had rarely seen a scene so bloody and sadistic. Officer Simons kept coming back to Jill's body. His instincts told him that she was the main target, and that is how he intended to focus his unofficial investigation. The death of the 3 teenagers also shocked the community, who woke to headlines from the Waco Tribune Herald reading, "Man, 2 teenage girls found stabbed to death at Lake Park. Police say bodies bound, girls nude." The murders caused panic in Waco, with some believing the murders were the work of Satan worshippers. Waco PD wanted to solve the case quickly in order to quell the worries of their citizens. The case was assigned to WPD Lieutenant Marvin Horton, who was the head of a 7-man task force investigating the murders. They were bombarded with hundreds of tips, For days, it seemed like their phones never stopped ringing, but none of the tips ever panned out. Despite not being officially assigned to the case, Officer Simon spent his free time at the lake, searching the woods and talking to people. This didn't surprise the other officers. Officer Simons was known to be a very dedicated policeman, especially with cases that affected him. Officer Simons found out a few weeks later, after looking at the case file on another officer's desk, that the case had gone inactive. Investigators had developed a few suspects, but there was not enough evidence to make any arrests. When he saw the case was going cold, Officer Simons asked Chief Scott if he could take over the case. The two men had a history and did not like each other, but Officer Simons made a very convincing argument to Chief Scott, and because the case had to be solved quickly, the chief agreed. Officer Simons would have the case solved in a week. The next day, Officer Simons, along with Officer Dennis Beyer, pulled all the police reports about the case and began to comb through them. They wanted to make sure that all leads were exhausted before they moved on. It wouldn't take them long before they came across a tip from 17-year-old Lisa Cater, who had lived with Kenneth and Jill at the Methodist home. Lisa had pointed the finger at Munir Deeb, a 23-year-old immigrant from Jordan who had ran a convenience store across the street from the Methodist home. Munir walked with a limp and was nicknamed Lucky. Officer Simons and Beyer looked into this lead. They found out that there had been an altercation between Kenneth and Munir. Kenneth had come into Munir's store to curse at him, using racial epithets and to make fun of his limp. The source of his anger was 16-year-old Gail Kelly, another teenager at the Methodist home. Gail often frequented Munir's store, and Munir developed a crush on the girl. The feelings were not mutual. The officers also heard from several witnesses that after finding out Kenneth was murdered, Munir laughed and said he was glad the boy was dead. Later that afternoon, Officer Simons and Beyer tracked down Gail in order to interview her. During the interview, Officer Simons asked Gail if anyone had ever told her she looked like Jill. Gail nodded, but Officer Beyer would later admit that he didn't see the resemblance. Still, this detail was something Officer Simons would mentally file away. Later that night, a frantic Gail called Officer Simons screaming, "He did it! He did it!" After composing herself, Gail told Officer Simons that Munir took her and a friend to a gory movie. Afterwards, he confessed that he killed Kenneth, Jill, and Raylene. Though he apologized and said he was joking, Gail didn't believe him. The next morning, Officer Simons called Chief Scott with the information he received from Gail. He wanted to move in on Munir as soon as possible because he was scared Munir would flee the state, seeing as the bank was currently closing on his home. Despite his partner's confidence, Officer Beyer didn't share the same enthusiasm. He didn't think there was enough evidence to arrest Munir, and several other investigators agreed with him. Chief Scott ultimately agreed with Officer Simons, and Munir was brought in for questioning that night. Munir was shocked by the accusation and proclaimed his innocence, but this did not deter Officer Simons from getting the information he wanted. He believed that Munir was too small to commit the crime by himself, so before his interview with Munir, Officer Simons got back in touch with Lisa and asked her if she could think of anyone who would have committed the crime with Munir. Lisa told Officer Simons about a man known as Chili, real name David Spence, who was a mean biker guy who hung out at Munir's convenience store. Back to the interrogation. Officer Simons asked Munir if he knew David, and Munir said yes. Officer Simons knew then he had his man. While he was on break from the interview, Officer Simons was approached by Sergeant Robert Fortune, another investigator on the case. Sergeant Fortune knew David Spence. He had just been arrested with his friend, Gilbert Melendez, for cutting a teenage boy on the leg and then forcing him to perform oral sex on Gilbert. Because David was arrested for a violent crime that involved a knife and sexual assault, he felt more sure that he was on the right track. A theory began to form in his mind, one that would influence the rest of the investigation. Officer Simons believed the true target was Gail, but attacked Jill by accident because they looked alike. Raylene and Kenneth were just collateral damage. Officer Simons was convinced Munir would crack under pressure and confess. Instead, Munir's family hired a lawyer. His lawyer pushed for a polygraph test, and Officer Simons agreed. After 3 hours of testing, the polygraph operator concluded that Munir gave no deception. Officer Simons was humiliated by the result. How could he have been so wrong? Officer Simons was the only one in the WPD that was surprised by the results. The other officers had, over time, come to distrust Officer Simons' tendency to follow his gut. He was also not well-liked because he was a loner in a job that needed its officers to collaborate. To the other officers, this was evidence of Officer Simons' shortcomings. He called evidence in a shady manner, and he was prone to fixation. It wasn't long before Officer Simons enacted another plan. He was still certain that Munir was guilty, and he was certain that David and Gilbert carried out the murders with him. He asked Chief Scott for a transfer to the county jail. The request confused the police chief because it meant a cut in pay and status, but he nonetheless granted Officer Simons' request. This put Officer Simons right where he wanted to be. David Spence was awaiting trial for aggravated sexual abuse in the county jail. Officer Simons would use that time to get a confession from David. Before he left the force, Officer Simons went to talk to David at the county jail. He brought Officer Byer with him. David was talkative and friendly, and the two fell easily into a conversation. David had no idea that Officer Simons considered him a suspect. He told the officer at the time of the murders, he worked at a hardware store next to Munir's convenience store. David's girlfriend, Christine Jewell, worked in Munir's store. David offered to have Christine ask around about the murders, and he would pass along the information to Officer Simons. David, though a violent criminal, was lonely in jail, so it was easy for Officer Simons to get close to him. Once he started working at the jail, the two men talked constantly about the Lake Waco murders, among other things. David seemed to really enjoy talking about the murders. Spence's lawyer for the sex abuse case, Walter Reeves, begged David not to talk to Officer Simons, but he didn't listen. Even after Officer Simons told David he was a suspect in the murders, David kept talking to him. Sure, he was shocked about the news, but since he hadn't been charged with anything, he thought it was okay to keep conversing with Officer Simons. In January, an inmate named Kevin Michael told Officer Simons that David had been bragging about the murders. He offered corroborating details such as the shoelaces used to bind Kenneth. Kevin also hinted that Gilbert Melendez was involved. David had met Gilbert through his older brother, Tony. David and Tony went to school together as kids. This was just the break that Officer Simons had been looking for. Soon, more inmates began to come forward with stories about David's admissions. One claimed to have heard David say the killings were part of a satanic ritual. Another claimed that a man named Lucky hired David and Gilbert to kill the girls because they dishonored him. Rather than take this information to Chief Scott, Officer Simons instead went to Waco's new district attorney, Vic Fizzall. The 31-year-old newly elected DA was looking to make a name for himself. He'd already shaken up the DA's office by implementing new protocols as well as installing a security system so sophisticated that people took to calling his office Fort Fizzall. After listening to what Officer Simons had to offer, Fizzall said that the testimony from the other inmates would most likely be dismissed as hearsay. Officer Simons was undeterred. He knew the key to getting the confession he needed was his friendship with David. Officer Simons continued to cultivate his relationship with David. David began to rely more and more on Officer Simons. He would often call him late at night after getting off the phone with Christine, terrified she was going to leave him. When she finally did, David had to be given a shot of Thorazine to calm down. Now, David's only friend in the world was the man trying to link him to a triple homicide. It was during this particularly vulnerable time that Officer Simons began to offer David an explanation. Maybe David had a split personality and his evil half, Chili, had committed the murders. David acquiesced to the idea, but said he didn't remember ever killing anyone. He would always stop short of confessing. 8 months after the murder, DA Faisal put together a task force. Despite some hesitancy concerning Officer Simons' methods, he included him in the task force along with two other officers familiar with the case, Officer Salinas and Beyer. The three men grew distant after Officer Simons began working in the jail. To combat that, Officer Salinas and Beyer worked the streets while Officer Simons continued working in the county jail. By this time, Officer Simons had set his sights on Gilbert Melendez, David's accomplice in the aggravated sexual assault case. Gilbert had been given 7 years for his role in the sexual assault case. Gilbert, like David and Munir, denied any involvement in the murders, but Officer Simons remained undeterred. The success he had with David just made him want to press Gilbert more. Officer Simons told Gilbert that the case was heating up and it may be in his best interest to testify against David in order to avoid the death penalty. After allowing Gilbert to stew for a few hours with this information, Officer Simons came back to a much more cooperative Gilbert. "I was out there," he said. When Officer Simons asked if he would talk about David's involvement, Gilbert replied, "I'll testify." By this time, David had been sentenced to 90 years in prison for the aggravated sexual assault case. Officer Simons set up a recorder for Gilbert's confession. Gilbert told him that he and David had been riding around in David's station wagon, drinking and smoking, when they happened upon the three teenagers. They enticed the trio with the promise of beer and weed, then drove them to the lake. Gilbert then said that David raped and stabbed Jill, then Raylene, and then finally killed Kenneth. After that, the two men drove the bodies to Spiegelville and dumped them there. Officer Simons was excited about the confession, but it was not without its flaws. For starters, the station wagon the pair supposedly drove around was not purchased by David until 2 weeks after the murders. Officer Simons went back to Gilbert to clear up his statement. He would even drive him to the crime scene. Over the next 2 days, Gilbert gave three statements, all of them with discrepancies. Officer Simons chalked this up to Gilbert's drug-addicted mind, but the other investigators were not as confident about the confession as Officer Simons was. After two polygraph tests that seemed to confirm Gilbert's confession, he then recanted entirely. No matter, he was still sent to prison. Officer Simons got another break in April 1983. He was contacted by Assistant DA Ned Butler, who told him that they would soon be able to prove David's involvement in the murders. Butler was a big proponent of forensic odontology and provided him with a mold of David's teeth and pictures of bite marks on the girls' bodies. Campbell compared the mold with the bite marks and declared that David Spence was the one who bit the girls. Officer Simons now had the forensic evidence he needed to bring David to trial. Not only did this confirm what Officer Simons believed all along, but it also won over DA Faisal. By this time, they added a fourth suspect, Gilbert's younger brother, Tony. At the time, Tony was wanted in Corpus Christi on robbery and rape charges. Waco PD hauled him in to question him about his brother's crimes. Tony insisted that he was in Bryan on a painting job, but officers heard him say he was in Waco. On November 21st, 1983, a McLennan County grand jury indicted Munir, David, Gilbert, and Tony for the Lake Waco murders. In April, a district judge decided the order of the trials would go like this. First David, then Gilbert, Tony, and Munir.
I'm going to pause the case right here
so you can hear a word from our sponsor. Right off the bat, David's lawyers, Russ Hunt and Hayes Fuller, felt their client was being railroaded. Officer Simon's unconventional investigation methods, combined with the forensic odontology that wasn't backed by actual science, caused the lawyers to continuously bring motions against the trial. When Judge Allen kept denying the motions, Hunt and Fuller went so far as to send a 33-page letter to the FBI and the U.S. Attorney's Office asking them to step in. Their pleas went unheard. The case against David was dealt another blow when Tony Melendez agreed to plead guilty and testify against David in exchange for a life sentence. David's lawyers could thank Officer Simons for this abrupt turnaround. Officer Simons had been visiting Tony in jail and interrogating him until he finally broke down. David's trial began on June 18, 1984. The courthouse was packed with media and spectators eager to witness the trial. The state claimed that Muneer had hired David and the Melendez brothers to kill Gail, but they had mistakenly killed Jill because she looked so much like Gail. Seven prison inmates testified that David bragged about the killings while in jail. They also claimed that they were not receiving anything in exchange for their testimony. The entire case was circumstantial, until Homer Campbell took the stand. Campbell testified that using electronically enhanced autopsy photos and the mold of David's teeth, he could conclude with reasonable certainty that David was the one who left the bite marks on the girls' bodies. David's attorneys tried their best. They wanted to introduce evidence showing the crime could have been committed by two different men. The defense had a theory that the crimes were committed by James Bishop, a former Waco resident who had moved to California right after the murders and then was arrested for raping and attempting to kill two high school girls, and Ronnie Breeton, a man who had been seen in bloody clothes after a night fishing on the lake. The judge, however, ruled the evidence irrelevant and would not allow the defense to bring it to trial. It took the jury only 2 hours to find David Spence guilty of capital murder. 3 days later, David was handed the death penalty. Not long after David's trial, Gilbert contacted Officer Simons. He wanted to make a deal to avoid the death penalty. In January 1985, Gilbert wrote out a 16-page confession, pled guilty for two life sentences, and agreed to testify against Muneer. Muneer's trial began on February 25th and lasted 12 days. During his trial, over 40 witnesses testified, many of them also having testified during David's trial. The most damning testimony came when Gilbert Melendez took the stand to tell the court that Muneer promised David $5,000 for killing Gail. It took the jury less than 2 hours to come back with a guilty verdict. Muneer was also given the death penalty. In October of that year, David was back in court, this time being tried for the death of Kenneth. His first trial was just for the murder of Jill. Again, testimonies against David included jailhouse informants as well as both Melendez brothers. Despite a few inconsistencies between the brothers' stories of what happened that night, David was found guilty of the murder of Kenneth and given the death penalty. Because the four men were safely behind bars, D.A. Faisal declined to continue prosecuting. The city of Waco was grateful for the convictions, and D.A. Faisal was riding high. However, he would soon come crashing down, thanks to the Dallas TV station WFAA, when it ran a 10-part investigative series on D.A. Faisal and his office. Some of the accusations against his office included dismissing DWI charges in exchange for money, amongst many other things. Faisal claimed it was just a smear campaign on him, but the damage was done. In June 1991, Muneer Deeb's murder conviction was overturned by the Court of Criminal Appeals. After his direct appeals went nowhere, Muneer studied law books and typed out law cases, trying to understand the rhythm of law writing. Eventually, he managed to write a 114-page writ of habeas corpus. the last appeal that can be made by a death row inmate. While not perfect, Muneer was able to make his case about his unfair trial. The court agreed and granted him a new trial based on the fact that any jail informant who testified against him was hearsay. David's appeals in 1991 were not going as well as Muneer's. After all appeals were exhausted, he was given an execution date of October 17, 1991. But the fight for his life wouldn't end there. Texas has a high number of executions every year, so a federally funded nonprofit organization was begun by anti-death penalty activists. The Texas Resource Center opened in Austin and offered pro bono legal help to death row inmates. Two young lawyers who worked for the TRC at the time were Rob Owen and Raul Schoeneman. They met each other while working on death penalty cases with the ACLU, or the American Civil Liberties Union. The lawyers who worked at the TRC had a very heavy caseload, and one more, added to Rob and Raul's plate, was David Spence. They received the case on Labor Day, 1991, 45 days before David was scheduled to be executed. The more they looked into the case, the more flabbergasted they were at David's conviction. It was well known in legal circles that evidence such as jailhouse testimony and bite mark forensics were unreliable. They also felt that the Waco Police Department did not do their due diligence in looking at other suspects. One such suspect, a man named Tab Harper, was seen at the park the night of the murders and had bragged about killing three people. On October 16th, a mere 14 hours before David was supposed to die, Rob and Raul filed a 164-page writ, claiming that after 6 weeks of investigation, they found evidence of state misconduct, including withholding exculpatory evidence and relying on a very dubious investigation. The court ordered a stay of execution until December 19th in order to give the state time to respond. The lawyers had bought themselves some time and intended to use it to track down all the jailhouse informants who testified against David. One of those informants, Jesse Ivy, testified that David had talked about killing the teenagers. Now he was telling Rob and Raul that David never said any of those things. He wrote in an affidavit, quote, "The murders made me very angry. You could say that Truman Simons and Ned Butler put the facts of the case in my mouth, and I put them into the mouths of the other guys in jail." Another inmate, Kevin Michael, explained how he knew the details of the crime when he testified against David. Quote, "Many times Simon fed me specific pieces of factual information about the crime, and then later asked me to relate the information back to him for one of my statements." Officer Simon showed Kevin pictures of the crime scene, which is how he knew about Raylene's bra being tied around her ankle. The lawyers also found two other informants who did not testify but were offered leniency and favorable treatment if they testified against David. Another piece of evidence they attacked was the bite mark evidence. They interviewed Lieutenant Horton, who stated in an affidavit that the medical examiner initially ruled that the marks on Jill's breast were not bite marks. It was only after she looked at photos and spoke with Ned Butler that she changed her mind. They also hired Thomas Krause, the former president of the American Board of Forensic Odontology, to provide expert testimony on the bite mark evidence. Krause deduced that Homer Campbell's methodology was well outside of the mainstream. The lawyers also found that 2 months after he testified against David, Campbell took impressions from an unidentified dead woman and declared without a doubt that she was a teenager from Florida who had been missing. The teenager later turned up alive. Rob and Raul filed a supplement to their habeas writs with the Court of Criminal Appeals. The judges denied their appeal. Their last option now was the federal courts. On December 18th, 1 day before David was scheduled to die, the lawyers filed for a stay of execution, as well as a federal habeas corpus petition, citing 25 grounds for reversal. The judges granted both. In April 1992, the federal court denied David's petition for habeas corpus relief. Desperate, Rob and Raul filed a motion to amend the judgment, and 4 months later, the courts granted them an evidentiary hearing. Around this time, Rob accepted a job in Kentucky and left the TRC, A new lawyer, Joel Schwartz, stepped in to help Raul. Raul had been periodically meeting with the Melendez brothers for their help. While they told them they lied in their statements, they refused to go on the record. The reason for this is that they were slated to testify against Munir in his retrial. They were promised help with their paroles if they did. The night before Munir's trial, something very surprising happened. Tony and Gilbert had been brought to Fort Worth to testify. They got the opportunity to see each other for the first time in 10 years. After talking, the brothers refused to take the stand against Munir. This completely changed the outcome of the trial. After 2 weeks of testimony, Munir was found not guilty. Because they chose not to testify, Raul decided to visit the brothers again to ask for their help. Each brother recanted their confession. Tony had learned about the crime from media and Officer Simons. He chose to plead guilty in order to avoid the death penalty. Gilbert also learned about the crime from media coverage. He went further to say that he was actively coached by Officer Simons during his statement in order to make it believable. Raul was astounded by what he was hearing. The icing on the cake was a statement he received from Chief Scott, who claimed that Officer Simons brought no less than 5 separate confessions to his office. This gave Chief Scott severe doubts about the confession. Lieutenant Horton also casted doubts on Officer Simons' method, saying, quote, "I heard Truman Simons say to Gilbert Melendez, 'Gilbert, we're going to turn the recorder off now and get our story straight, and then we'll turn the recorder back on.' I remember thinking that that was the stupidest thing I had ever heard an investigator say." In October 1993, Raul and Joel filed all the paperwork they had for David's case. They felt confident that they would be granted a new trial. On February 16, 1994, the courts responded by saying they felt there was not sufficient evidence to grant David a new trial. Raul tried again and filed with the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals in December 1994. In September 1995, the TRC had to shut its doors due to Congress no longer willing to fund the nonprofit agency. Raul wouldn't let this stop him. He got a new job at the Capital Punishment Clinic at the University of Texas Law School and continued to represent David pro bono. In March 1996, the Fifth Circuit turned down David's appeals. While the court recognized some evidence had been withheld from the defense, they felt it wouldn't have been enough to change the outcome of the trial. In February 1997, David received his new execution date, April 3, 1997. By this time, David had resigned to his fate. Raul tried to gain a pardon from Governor George Bush's office. He met with 2 of the governor's legal aides. After explaining the case, one aide told Raul, "You've convinced me that something's seriously wrong with Waco law enforcement, but you haven't convinced me that Spence is innocent." On the morning of April 3rd, David met with his loved ones, including his ex-wife, one of his sons, and his brother. He was executed via lethal injection. At 6:32 p.m., he was pronounced dead. In October 1998, Gilbert Melendez died in prison from complications of HIV. Munir Deeb died of liver cancer in 1999. In January 2017, Tony Melendez, the last of the 4 men implicated in the murders of Kenneth Franks, Jill Montgomery, and Raylene Rice, died in a prison hospice at the Michael Unit in Tennessee Colony. The prison would not release the cause of death due to privacy laws. Also in 2017, Spence's sons, Jason and Joel Spence, brought a lawsuit against the state, claiming that Texas bribed witnesses, coerced confessions, and used junk science in order to secure a conviction against innocent men for the murders at Lake Waco. The complaint claims that newly discovered testimony, new scientific methods and evaluations, and hidden evidence uphold all of their defenses. They reason that if Deeb was later acquitted for the crime, then the other men should have been acquitted as well. The Spence brothers point the finger squarely at Officer Simons, claiming he was desperate to make the case fit his theory and was willing to do whatever he could in order for the DA to secure a conviction. The bite mark evidence that was later used to convict Spence was later deemed unreliable by the Texas Forensic Science Commission in a 1,300-page report they released in 2016. The commission concluded that the overwhelming majority of existing research does not support the contention that bite mark comparison can be performed reliably and accurately from examiner to examiner due to the subjective nature of the analysis. Another damning claim from the lawsuit is that tape recordings from McLennan County District Attorney Vic Fizell prove that he colluded with Spence's court-appointed lawyer in order to secure a conviction. The Spence brothers are asking for compensation for wrongful imprisonment, attorney fees, and full pardons for all defendants. As of February 2019, there's no update on the status of the lawsuit. There's so much to this case that I didn't have time to cover. If you're interested, please check out the Texas Monthly's article, The Murders at the Lake. I would also recommend the book, Careless Whispers, which won the Edgar Award in 1986. The book was written by Carlton Stowers and had Officer Simons as the protagonist. It's a great way to see the case the way Officer Simons did. Okay, fan club members, as I conclude this episode, my one question to you is, how will you sleep tonight? Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please be sure to leave us a positive review on Apple Podcasts or your podcast player of choice. It really does help us out. You can find us on most social media platforms, Twitter at TCFCpod, Facebook.com/TCFCpodcast. You can also find us on Instagram, TCFC_podcast. And of course, our website is TrueCrimeFanClub.com. If you have an episode request, send us an email, TCFCpod@gmail.com. Music for the show was provided by We Talk of Dreams, who created custom music just for us. Check him out on Twitter at WeTalkOfDreams or WeTalkOfDreams.com. Content warning at the top of the show was provided by Tyler Allen, host of the Minds of Madness podcast. This episode of True Crime Fan Club was written and researched by Brittany Martinez.